Welcome to the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR, where we talk to business leaders from around Ireland and share their advice on how to create the HR systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, simply visit www.insighthr.ie/podcast. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Okay, let's get started.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HR Room Podcast. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? We've all heard this on criminal dramas from the US, but of course, things aren't always as simple as they sound. And when we talk about the right to silence here in Ireland, under the lens of a workplace investigation, it's certainly a little bit different, to say the least. So to talk about this, along with a case that has brought this topic to the forefront of employment law here in Ireland, we're delighted to be joined by Barry Crushell, Principal Solicitor at Crushell & Co. Law at Work. Thanks for joining us again, Barry. How are you?
Great. Good to be here. Looking forward to discussing this emerging issue.
That's it. Brilliant. And we're the very same. And as always, we're joined by our very own Mary Cullen, Founder and Managing Director here at Insight HR. How are you, Mary?
I'm great, thanks. And our listeners out there should read Barry's article on this as well, which is where we came across it, and very interesting stuff. But we'll let you explain first, Barry.
That's it. And I'll actually link that in the show notes as well, so people can visit it at the click of a button from this episode. So look, let's jump right in. And as Mary said, Barry, we'll come to yourself first, just for a bit of context, I suppose. So I suppose before we jump into the details of the case, Barry, what do we kind of mean, first of all, by the right to silence in workplace investigations, just for anyone that's not too familiar?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because it's one that has popped its head up before. But a definitive answer has probably never been provided by a superior Irish court. And I had an opportunity to review a case recently where this topic was addressed. And in advance of our meeting today, I reread that decision yet again, just to trace back where that right arises from. And very interestingly, I mean, one of the things you started with, Owen, was, you know, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law, which is very much an American slogan that most listeners will be familiar with if they've watched any crime drama. But in the decision that we will discuss later on, there is a lot of reference to the Fifth Amendment in the United States. And the Fifth Amendment is a right to silence amendment in the United States Constitution. And that basically means that somebody has the right not to self-incriminate. And throughout the decision that we will discuss, the court uses that phrase, right to silence, and right not to self-incriminate, on an almost interchangeable basis. And the right to silence derives initially from a common law practice, whereby people were either, I'm going to use the phrase, damned if they do and damned if they don't, in that if they said something about their case, it could be used against them. But if they said nothing, that would also be used against them. And so there was a common law position adopted, which was given, I suppose, articulation in the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, which clarified that in accordance with due process and fair procedure and natural justice, an individual shall not be required to give any testimony against themselves. And that position was enshrined in our own Constitution. However, the right to silence at work was always considered a separate right, if it existed at all. There was a question mark as to whether a right to silence existed within the workplace context, because the right to silence in general was there to prevent individuals from oppression from the state. And when I mean the state, I mean the authorities on Garda Síochána, primarily any prosecutions that would be made against them. And so an argument had been made by employers over the last 100 or so years that an employment contract was not a contract between the citizen and the state, but between two private legal entities, one being a person and one being potentially a commercial entity, and that as a private arrangement, no right to silence arose, and that there would have been the possibility that a failure of an employee to answer queries or their invoking a right to silence might have been a breach of the contract in two things: that it might have been a failure to carry out proper instructions that were given by an employee, an employer to an employee. And it might have amounted to what was called a repudiatory breach of the contract. That effectively an employer would say, hey, if we're asking you these questions and you refuse to give us any answers, then we're effectively going to argue that this amounts to a failure to fulfill your obligations to us as an employee. We're paying your salary, we're paying your wages, we expect certain things from you. And one of those is to answer any reasonable inquiries that we may make of you, particularly when it relates to any investigation or disciplinary proceedings that may arise. And so the question mark as to whether there was a right to silence within the workplace has, to my knowledge, one that hasn't been adequately answered. There are various cases where it was addressed, but it hasn't adequately been answered until now. And so when we say, is there a right to silence in the context of a working relationship, I think the outcome of the decision that we will discuss is yes, but in very limited circumstances.
And Mary, I suppose before we jump into the details of the case, which we're, we have people hanging on the edge here to listen to it, the suspense is killing them, I'm sure. But just an important question before we jump into that, Mary. I know you and the team have done countless workplace investigations over the years, and I'm sure Barry is also quite familiar with workplace investigations, to say the least. But Mary, is this something that, I mean, is this kind of an outlier of a topic? Does this come quite often? Is it something that has crossed your desk, I suppose, in the years, this whole area around whether it's defined or not, or invoked or not, this right to silence in workplace investigations?
I have only ever come across it once in an investigation that I did personally years ago, where an employee who was accompanied by a solicitor at that time, which was reasonably unusual in the circumstances, but it involved theft and or alleged theft. And I was tasked with carrying out that particular investigation. And every single question I asked, the employee answered, no comment, no comment, no comment. And I tried to urge them to cooperate with me or to put forward information in their own defense. And, you know, that particular person at that particular time refused to do so, supported by their solicitor. And it was the first time I had ever come across that. And again, it wasn't about the workplace issue, because from the workplace perspective, I was going to base my report on the evidence that was in front of me, and on the balance of probabilities, a decision was going to be, you know, I was going to outline in my report the information that I had already, and the company then were going to act upon that. And in that particular case, I think there was a dismissal. I wasn't involved thereafter. But at the time, I spoke to an employment lawyer I was dealing with, and I kind of said, well, what's this? You know, what's this? Why would someone say no comment? Why wouldn't they defend themselves and say it wasn't true and all of that? And I think in that case, because there was compelling evidence against that individual, and the company were going to go to the Gardaí, and they were protecting against something bigger and more serious than the fact that the individual was going to lose their job. So I have come across it. It's not all that common. It might become more common after this case, but I have never seen it outside of theft and fraud, really, other than maybe an employee in a bullying, harassment, sexual harassment, you know, kind of just refusing to cooperate and trying to deal with that. It's not unusual in really tricky cases where somebody's job may be on the line or their reputation may be on the line for them to refuse to give you any information or answer your questions. But we'll always say the same thing, that we will, if they don't, we will base the report on the information that's actually in front of us.
Definitely. So Barry, if we might jump into the details of the case that we're speaking about today, and if I might double up a little bit, just with a nod to that last question, if you might just let us know, is this case a bit of an outlier, as we said, or is it something that comes up quite often?
In terms of whether it comes up often, again, I represent both employers and employees, and generally speaking, when an employee comes to me and they're facing an investigation or a disciplinary process, I do encourage them, as far as practicable, to answer the replies that their employer has given them, potentially prepare a statement to kind of control their narrative as much as they can, and to ensure that if this matter was picked up at a later date by an adjudication officer or a chairperson of the Labour Court, that they will have been seen to have fully participated in any investigation, that they will have given honest replies, and that the optics of their behavior would have been considered commendable. Because very often I say to my employee clients, the optics of how you react to an investigation can have a lot of significance on how you might be perceived at a later date. However, there are occasions when I have concerns that the allegations that are being made against an employee might have application outside of the workplace realm, and as Mary has already alluded to it. By way of reference, we have had individuals come to us to say that they have been or are to be the subject of an investigation for sexual harassment. And in those circumstances, once we get a little deeper, we may say, look, you need to speak to a criminal law solicitor, as I have concerns as an employment lawyer that the advice that I give you in an employment context may potentially prejudice any position that you advance at a later date. And so I need to proceed with caution. And again, only yesterday I advised a potential client in relation to what was an investigation concerning theft, but the company, you know, described it as the removal from the premises of X, Y, and Z. So in a situation like this, I have to be mindful when I'm advising an employee that they could face consequences outside of the workplace that are more consequential than a sanction or losing their job. And in those scenarios, I do advise them to speak. And we have, you know, we have counsel that we refer to and bring them on board, brief them, and they are advised of the context in which this employee has come to us. But as Mary has said, and I suspect that the individual or the solicitor or the barrister who accompanied that employee, who she gave an example of, that lawyer was probably more interested in the long-term ramifications of any answers that would be given. And so it would be very unusual from my perspective to see an employee invoke a right to silence. Very often I have rarely, if ever, seen it. And the only time I have ever seen it is if there were more severe consequences coming down the line. And in those scenarios, with considerable regret, very often the investigation or disciplinary process doesn't necessarily reach a conclusion. Because if the outcome of an investigation is, you know, conclusive that this individual has committed illegality and the writing's on the wall, my advice to an employee at that stage is to consider your own options. Are you going to wait for the inevitable sanction that follows or whatnot? So it doesn't come up very often. It's very rare. But as Mary alluded to now, I think this is going to be something that employers, employees, and HR professionals will need to work through. Because again, we can discuss it you know, later on. But I think every case will be quite unique, and the application of these facts to individual cases, you know, will need to be examined closely before anybody is definitive about what an employer or an employee can or cannot do.
Definitely. Yeah, so go ahead, Mary. Any kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah, I, in my experience, a lot of the time when people are accused of theft or fraud or something like that, very quickly they're trying to move to a situation where they resign and repay the money or give back whatever it was that was taken from their employer and looking to put in place a termination agreement rather than go through an investigation and a potential disciplinary process. Again, mindful, I think, of the potential ramifications of Gardaí involvement and later conviction for a crime or a criminal offence. And so these are really tricky areas, really, really tricky areas, I think. But it's also another thing that I have seen regularly happen. And so therefore, it doesn't get this far. And I think that's probably why we don't see a lot of it, because right at the first meeting or interview with someone, someone's putting up their hand and saying, listen, I prefer not to proceed. Is there any way to avoid this? And my advice is go back to your employer and speak to your employer. We'll suspend what we're doing here. You speak to your employer, and once they instruct me to proceed, I'll proceed. And often it gets settled at that point. You know, but it's tricky. It's tricky and messy often.
So Barry, how did this case go, the one we're speaking about today? And could you talk to us a little bit about how the courts kind of came to the decision?
Yeah, it's a very interesting case. So in summary, ESB Electricity Supply Board, they had an employee, Mr. Kieran Sharkey. In summary, two property companies came to ESB and said, we are being asked for cash payments by some of your employees in order to progress works being done on a particular site in Malahide. And what happened was the ESB wrote to Mr. Sharkey and said that, look, we have initiated proceedings against two construction companies, and we're seeking documentation and information in relation to certain allegations that have been made to ESB in respect of cash payments being made to our employees in order to prioritize the work of these of these building contractors. And they said that you are one of the employees referenced in the allegations. There are high court orders in place to compel these companies to provide us with relevant documentation. Not only that, but those proceedings were in public. And because your name has been mentioned as an individual who may have potentially received cash payments, we now have an obligation to put this to you and to seek your replies in respect of these accusations. And so they wrote to Mr. Sharkey and said, can you confirm if you've ever received any payment in cash or otherwise from any of these entities, or if you, on what date those payments were made, if any, and just other details to sort of figure out, are you involved in this? What happened was that rather than reply to that letter directly, Mr. Sharkey engaged his solicitor. And his solicitor wrote to the company to note that in circumstances where there was an ongoing criminal investigation into the conduct of Mr. Sharkey, his client, he has advised, and that's very important, he has advised his client to invoke his right to silence and not to answer any queries that ESB have raised. And what's very important about that is that he also denied any wrongdoing, but assured the company that when the criminal proceedings had come to a conclusion, that he would be very open to giving responses. What ESB responded with was effectively the core of their case, which is that the that Mr. Sharkey has an obligation to obey all reasonable and lawful directions given to him by his line manager. And they also noted that there's an implied obligation of cooperation under employment law, and that an ongoing refusal to provide the information requested could amount to a repudiatory breach of the contract if the information wasn't supplied by a particular date. And they gave Mr. Sharkey a deadline to reply. Now, the response of the solicitor, Mr. Sharkey's solicitor, was quite animated. And I just have a copy of that letter and one of the paragraphs that I want to highlight, and I used a quotation. Are your clients seriously suggesting that any contractual obligation my client may have on foot of his contract of employment overrides his constitutionally enshrined right to silence in the context of a criminal investigation? End quotation. And they also went on to note, we invite you to issue legal proceedings seeking a declaration that my client, Mr. Sharkey, by invoking his right to silence, has repudiated his contract. So they basically put it up to ESB. They said, look, if you, we're claiming that our client has a right to silence. That's our position. And that his constitutionally enshrined right to a right to silence overrides any obligation he has as an employee to his employer. And if you guys want to, certainly bring this to the High Court and seek some orders from the High Court in respect of how this matter should be managed. And that's exactly what ESB did. They brought an order to the High Court in May 2023, and they're asking the court for a number of questions. Did Mr. Sharkey, as an employee, have a right to silence or self-incrimination? And that as a result of that right, was he permitted not to answer the queries raised by the employer? If the answer is no, does his refusal to do so amount to a repudiatory breach of his contract of employment? And if the answer to that question was yes, then when was the employment contract terminated? So effectively, what they were asking the court is, does he have a right to silence in the context of a workplace investigation? If the answer is no, has he breached his contract of employment? And if he has breached his contract of employment, when did that arise? For example, did it arise the moment he said, I refuse to answer any questions? Now, in terms of the High Court decision, the High Court was a lot of analysis on this. The decision, the judgment comes to approximately 40 pages, and it delves through the concept of the right to silence and self-incrimination in general, how it became enshrined in the Irish Constitution and the jurisprudential developments that arose to bring us to the point that we are at today. But there were a number of decisions that were referenced, which the High Court took into account. So the, one of the first things that the High Court said is that the Constitution, Article 40, provides that there is a right to fair procedure. And even in the employment context, notwithstanding the fact that it's a private relationship. And it mentioned about Haughey, the case of Haughey, in that in the realm of private law or public law, that there are certain decisions that may impact individuals' rights, and therefore they should be subject to due process and fair procedure. But I went on to speak about probably three cases, if I may just quickly reference. One was Mooney v. En Poste. And in that case, it was noted that the entitlement of an employee to refuse to answer questions, that this is a case where that this question came up. And Barrington J in that decision said that an employer was entitled to a candid response from an employee when misgivings were put to them. And in that case, rejected that there had been a breach of fair procedures. In another case, which was HV Governor of a Prison of the Irish Prison Service, the High Court said that there is a presumption that an employee may be entitled to rely on a privilege against self-incrimination, but it wasn't necessarily expanded upon. And then there was an interesting decision in Carroll versus Law Society. And in that case, the High Court was asked to restrain disciplinary proceedings that were initiated by the Law Society against a solicitor. But in that case, the solicitor argued that the procedures were unfair. And one of the matters relied upon by the by Carroll, the solicitor, was that although it was accepted that he could invoke the privilege of against self-incrimination before the disciplinary committee, doing so might undermine his ability to defend himself in the disciplinary proceedings. And again, so what has happened is there's been case law where this issue has been raised, but no definitive answer was given. And in this case, the courts came on the side of Mr. Sharkey, but albeit in a very limited fashion. And they effectively said that, look, this individual is potentially facing criminal sanction. Therefore, the answers he gives in the context of an employment investigation could prejudice him later in criminal proceedings, and that there is undue pressure being put on him to answer those queries because the threat of potentially losing his job was potentially a greater sanction than any criminal sanction that he could receive at a later date. And therefore, it was compelled speech, effectively. This isn't a direct quotation, but they're saying that it effectively is compelled speech. But that until such time as the criminal proceedings had come to a conclusion, he was under no obligation to answer any of the inquiries relating to the subject matter put to him by his employer. But as soon as those criminal proceedings came to an end, that obligation arose, and a failure to do so would amount to a repudiatory breach of the contract of employment. Now, that is going to create a big dilemma for a lot of employers, because the concern that I have, and maybe Mary can probably speak to this, is what if no criminal proceedings have yet commenced, but there's the potential that they may do so? What if no file has been put forward to the Director of Public Prosecutions? What if no criminal complaint has been made, but an employee may say, well, what you're accusing me of is effectively criminal behavior, and on foot of my potentially answering these queries, I could potentially incriminate myself and face criminal sanction down the road. So this is opening a Pandora's box. And my major concern, and I think probably Mary can speak to this, is what do you do now when an employee invokes that right? Because we're not talking about days or weeks. We're talking about months or years before we could even have a decision to potentially prosecute. And effectively, both the employer and the employee could be left in limbo during that period of time.
100%. Yeah, so Mary, I suppose, yeah, any thoughts on that? I mean, some cases, as Barry said, some cases can offer a fundamental change in an area. Some cases can offer a lot of clarity in an area. But as Barry says, there's some concerns around this one. What's the kind of thoughts, reflections from a you and client perspective, Mary, on that?
I think the first major issue would be what happens. Because if someone is accused of something in the workplace that's potentially criminal in nature, usually the first step is to consider suspension and paid suspension. And as Barry says, if the police take their time investigating a matter and put forward the file to the DPP, and eventually you get into a court, and eventually there is a conviction and maybe a sentence at a later date, or not, and often that doesn't happen. What does the employer do other than carry the cost of the employee's suspension until the conclusion of such an outcome, or I suppose until there is such an outcome? And that is not guaranteed. And in my experience from dealing with our clients who face maybe theft in the workplace or fraud in the workplace, the idea of paying someone for a couple of years may not appeal. And certainly it's one of the big problems always we see when we carry out a workplace investigation. The call that comes in is, we have an employee on suspension. When can we expect the report? Because, you know, now it's gone on for 1 week, 2 weeks, a month, 10 months, 12 months, you know, whatever it might be, depending on the complexity of the investigation. That's the call that we usually get. Because it's, where is this report? We're paying somebody while you're investigating it. And, you know, very often workplace investigations are tricky anyway, tricky by their nature. And people might be deliberately avoiding you getting to the point of drafting your report and issuing your report. And it's one of the things that a good workplace investigator is doing anyway, is moving along all the time. No matter how smart somebody's employment lawyer is, our job is to push it along. Someone else's job might be to prevent it getting to that point just yet, to give the employee time. And so I see it as a really significant decision and a really serious matter for employers. I would imagine that there would be far more likely to be those termination agreements put in place. I'm accused of something. I'll walk away with my reputation intact. You won't disparage me in any way, shape or form. We'll pass, you know, a euro between us as this deal between us, so that it'll take effect and, you know, it'll all be tied up in that way. But that's tricky too. So it's really not straightforward. But I see a lot of pressure from employers around that point. The suspension will be the issue. And then how long is a reasonable suspension, Barry? That's another point, isn't it? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Well, it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because they do reference a suspension within the actual decision. And the example given was Flynn v. En Poste, where the Supreme Court found that an employee's suspension had become invalid by reason of the passage of time, and that effectively it was just too long of a period, and the employee could consider potentially their employment to have been terminated by the employer. So we have a catch-22 scenario whereby an employee may invoke their right to silence. The employee is saying that effectively, if you suspend me for too long, I will consider that a repudiatory breach of your contract, while the employer is saying that if you don't answer our queries, it amounts to a repudiatory breach of contract. And the point that you made, Mary, about people not envisaging individuals being on suspension for a prolonged period of time is a very valid one. And that's probably in the context of an employer anticipating that where they suspend an individual, that there would be an investigation that would be carried out forthwith, that there would be a report, that there would be disciplinary proceedings, there would be an appeals process or whatnot. In that type of scenario, you know, the timelines can vary. The timelines can vary greatly. If an employer is now faced with the prospect, on foot of their own contract of employment and company handbook, that they don't have any suspension without pay, that this individual could be on their books potentially suspended and there's no way to redeploy them, I could envisage an employer making a commercial decision and effectively saying, look, if we were to terminate this individual's employment, they have an obligation to mitigate their losses. And that could actually be more financially advantageous for us to pay 3 or 6 months' salary to this person in an unfair dismissal claim where we agree that due process and fair procedure wasn't followed, you know, accept a sanction of loss of earnings only, rather than put somebody on pay and being suspended for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, you know, however long it is necessary. So I think this is, as I said, it's a can of worms. It's a Pandora's box that's being opened now. And I think any employer who faces an employee in the future who's refusing to answer queries in respect of certain issues that may be the subject of an investigation that might have a, you know, criminal sanction alluding to it, I think they're going to be tasked with some very tough decisions to make.
Can I ask a quick question, Barry, just around frustration of contract? You know, if somebody refuses to, if you've suspended them, they refuse to, in effect, cooperate with the investigation, and you're in a position as an employer to wait until the end of or the outcome of criminal proceedings if you're going down that route. Could the contract be said to be frustrated by reason of their refusal to participate in the investigation or to comment on the allegations that are being put to them?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And again, a decision that is referred to a lot in that context is the decision of Mooney v. En Post. And that was where the Supreme Court held that an employer was entitled to a candid response from an employee when they were the subject of an investigation or disciplinary process. Once those processes were fair, independent, and impartial. And very often, what may arise is, again, we represent employers as well. And I say that, you know, the steps that you have taken as an employer to carry out an investigation, disciplinary process, and a right of appeal will de-risk the likelihood of a successful complaint being taken against you in the future. A lot of employers may have already come to a conclusion, and I'm just being very candid about that, about the future of an employee within the workplace once an accusation of some merit has been made against them. And they may go through a process. And in terms of, we have had cases whereby individuals have been, for example, their employment has been terminated for gross misconduct, but they've been given a right of appeal at a later date. And so that the employer is sort of ticking a box in that, well, based on the evidence that was available to us, we brought this individual in with it for a meeting. Their responses, they didn't provide responses, or their responses were inadequate. And on that basis, we were going to terminate their employment for gross misconduct. I suspect, and I'm, again, just even in my own mind teasing this out, that rather than face an employee who invokes a right to silence and suspending an employee, many employers may just say, well, actually, this constitutes gross misconduct. We're going to avoid a scenario whereby we're suspending an employee with pay for a prolonged period of time. We'll take the risk of potentially terminating their employment with immediate effect for gross misconduct. We might offer them a right of appeal, but it's potentially a better outcome for us than, you know, engaging in what would be a prolonged and complicated process where the right to silence has been invoked and an investigation hasn't commenced. But to go back to your original point, I mean, the established case law to date is that employers are entitled to a candid response from employees where queries or concerns are put to them by their employer, and that a failure to offer, you know, a response, you know, may amount to a repudiatory breach of the contract. And I think, as you'll be well aware, I think ultimately, if a decision is made to terminate an individual's employment, again, the process doesn't need to be perfect. The more perfect it is, the less risk. But certainly where an accusation has been put to an employee, they've been offered the opportunity to respond. Those responses are inadequate, or they invoke potentially at this point their right to silence before any criminal proceedings may have been even considered or initiated. Then the decision to terminate their employment might be considered a reasonable one. And so maybe we might see a scenario whereby employers are getting ahead of criminal proceedings and potentially taking actions strategically, you know, before that becomes a real consideration.
It's always a bit of a challenging one, isn't it, Barry, when you look at this whole area, because, you know, as a director of a company, you have a duty to report a crime. And at the same time, as a director of a company, you also have to be quite strategic in terms of how you handle something like this, because if you don't report a crime to the Gardaí and you proceed with the workplace investigation first and then report the crime on foot of the findings of the investigation, you know, it's a real tricky one, I think, this whole area.
It is a very tough one. And again, we're seeing a lot of this at the moment, particularly where accusations of sexual harassment have been made. And that's generally, for me, when an employer's ears really do prick up and they say, out of an abundance of caution, we are going down this route, because it involves an accusation that has been made by one employee against another or whatnot. If it comes to something along the lines of theft, maybe the employer will say, well, look, we're not necessarily, it's us as the company, as a director, you know, we will carry out our own investigations first to see if, you know, we actually want to report this to An Garda Síochána, because it's our property that has been, you know, it's our property rights that have been infringed. In my experience, where there are accusations that are being made that may have, whereby the rights of, you know, an employee may have been infringed, that's potentially where an, you know, an employer, a director, you know, board of directors may say, out of an abundance of caution, you know, do we raise this with An Garda Síochána? Because of the way this may progress, and I'm increasingly seeing that happen. As I said, particularly where there's accusations or the potential accusations of assault, sexual assault, or anything that is, you know, sort of bordering on the offenses against a person. But you are right. In terms of the risks there, legal, commercial, reputational, it's a very tricky one for employers to navigate.
I suppose this is typically, the last question is typically a little bit easier than what I imagine it'll be today when I come to both of you. For this, I'll come to yourself first, Barry. When it comes to that, I suppose, kind of brief couple of lines of advice for HR teams and employers when it comes to this kind of stuff. I mean, does it go back to, Barry, the fundamentals of those preventative mitigation, clear procedures, that kind of thing? Any, I suppose, kind of, again, a tough one to ask, I know, but any kind of snippets of advice as we close out?
I've only ever written on our website once about a suspension without pay sanction. And that was an individual who was given 1 day suspension without pay, and it had a value of 176 euro. And the individual brought a claim to the Workplace Relations Commission under the Payment of Wages Act. And the adjudicator found that there hadn't been, either in the contract or in the company handbook, a provision for a suspension without pay. So I think there will be debate on this topic, and there may need to be a revision of company handbooks, whereby a prolonged suspension may arise as a result of an employee invoking a right to silence. Because I don't think it would be unreasonable for an employer to say, we cannot continue to pay an employee until criminal proceedings, which could take several years to conclude. So that is something that they would need to look at. I also think strategically, as I mentioned earlier, I think some employers will possibly want to get ahead of this topic by potentially being preemptive. And generally, where there are criminal proceedings, where there is the prospect of criminal proceedings, to me, in my mind, it would invoke the possibility that there has been some form of gross misconduct. And obviously, employers can potentially terminate employment with immediate effect where there is gross misconduct, but we caution them in doing so. I think we are going to need to see how and when this case is relied upon in the future, to what extent it's invoked and elaborated upon. And I know in my mind, just by way of example, we've got a number of proceedings in the Workplace Relations Commission whereby we're representing employers, and there are parallel criminal proceedings. And in those situations, the WRC and the employers have said the WRC proceedings cannot progress because it might unfairly prejudice the criminal proceedings. As a result of this decision, we will be writing, you know, to the WRC and seeking clarification, noting that, well, look, our clients have a right to silence, but if they volunteer information, and if they feel as if they are comfortable potentially incriminating themselves, that's a right that they can invoke. And therefore, there should be no reason why WRC proceedings cannot progress. But I think this is going to be a very seismic decision in respect of both internal investigations and disciplinary process, but also externally in the Workplace Relations Commission, where individuals are filing complaints. Because as of yet, in terms of having parallel criminal and employment law proceedings, it is still, to some extent, a very gray area. and hopefully some decisions will be issued in due course that will provide some further clarity.
And then I suppose similar question to yourself, Mary, and perfect segue, because the word I was going to mention there, Mary, was clarity. I suppose while we wait for clarity on decisions and precedent and that kind of stuff, I suppose it does go back to those fundamentals of finding clarity where you can in your procedures, in how you run investigations, that kind of stuff, doesn't it?
Without a doubt. I mean, it's an ever-changing landscape, isn't it? And you know, more and more and more now, people are outsourcing investigations rather than trying to rely on internal teams to deal with them, simply because the issues are complex and many. And, you know, just by this conversation alone, talking to Barry, you know, we've got the corporate responsibility of directors to report a crime. We've got the decision that's just been made. We've got suspension, and we've got, you know, an investigation with someone's right to invoke silence. And if you don't know what you're doing, as an employer, as a HR person, if you don't know what you're doing, you can walk yourself into such an unholy and humongous mess that you really do need advice when you're dealing with sexual harassment, when you're dealing with bullying, when you're dealing with theft or fraud. You really do need to reach out and speak to someone and not attempt to address internally in the first place, unless you have a hell of a lot of experience in this area. I happened to come across Barry's article, and it was really interesting because I've dealt with lots of, you know, frustrated contracts, fraud and theft, people going into jail, conviction and sentencing, what you do in the meantime, sex offences, whatever. This comes into the workplace and it's not straightforward. So my advice is reach out, talk to someone, know what you're doing, and be strategic. You may need to make these commercial decisions. You may need to wait until you know, not get into a parallel reporting of a crime to the Gardaí at the same time as the workplace investigation. You may need to protect yourselves as directors in those circumstances as well. So there's lots and lots and lots of things to be thought about here, and commercial decisions to be made.
Definitely. I mean, look, I suppose it's a great one to talk about, and a great one to I suppose get some great detail from two experts on it. So hopefully that does alleviate some stress for people and makes it a little bit clearer. But we do wait for that further clarity from what happens next. So look, thank you, Mary and Barry, for a very, again, practical, useful discussion, as we always say. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll catch you next week for the next installment of our podcast. So don't forget to click subscribe and join the discussion on our social media channels. If you are enjoying these episodes, do please feel free to share them with colleagues, friends, and family, especially ones that are quite deep and detailed like this, that can be of real value to people. And even better, if you can leave us a review on whatever platform you're on, we'd really appreciate it. And as always, for HR consultancy services and management you can trust, get in touch with us today at insidehr.ie. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us today on the HR Room Podcast, the podcast series from Insight HR that helps you create the human resources systems and workplace culture that's right for your business. For show notes and bonus content, go to www.insighthr.ie/podcast. That's www.insighthr.ie/podcast. We'd love it if you subscribe, like, and share the show with any friends and colleagues who are looking for fresh ideas on how to create the ideal workplace for their business. And remember, if you need any HR support, get in touch with us at Insight HR. Whether it's conducting a complex workplace investigation, filling a gap by providing you with a virtual or an on-site HR resource, or providing advice via our HR support line, we'll help you resolve whatever human resources challenge your business is facing. Thanks, and see you soon.